We have all encountered that certain child in the grocery store or a superstore, that child who has spotted something that he or she wants, who becomes very angry and whiny. Mommy, I need that. Please, please, I've got to have. And all of us has a little child like that somewhere deep inside of us that occasionally pops out when we're out and about shopping, when we see something that we've just got. Oh, God, please, I need that. Why can't I? We all have our weaknesses. We all have our moments. And confession is good for the soul. So somebody tell me, when you're out and about, what is it that tends to trip your wire and turn you into that needy little child? Oh, I want that. Somebody tell me, what's your weakness? Shoes. Get that. Pastor Vivian is confessing this morning. Shoes. Anybody else?
Anything.
Anything. Okay. Anything that catches your eye. Mike loves antiques. What else? Tesla. Somebody said a car. Clothes. Crystals. Yes. All those tools. They look good. They're very impressive when people see them in your garage, right? For me, my weakness is art. I remember a time 25 years ago when I was standing in a fine arts studio in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., gazing at a painting that to me was absolutely magnificent. It was huge, 7 feet tall, 4 feet wide, an abstract work. The title of it was God's Spirit. It was done mostly in shades of brown, but there were accents of bright orange and yellow, and it created the abstract image of the concentrated presence of infinite energy, kind of like I would imagine what Moses saw at the burning bush. My description does not even begin to do it justice. I can't explain it, but it was magnificent. I stood there thinking how wonderful it would be in my home if only I could have that. And it wasn't very expensive. Only $7,000. And there was this voice in the back of my head that said, this is why God created credit cards. Jeff, you could have this. You could have this shipped to your home today. Go ahead, get it. We've all experienced that. That push-pull. The things that money and credit cards can buy versus what makes sense in our life. So today, as we're continuing through our Getting Myself Together sermon series, let's take a little bit of time to think about the power of money in our lives and how we as followers of Jesus should relate to it, starting with prayer. God, scholars remind us that the Bible talks about money more than any other practical subject, more than even grace and love, probably because money affects virtually every aspect of life. And if we don't get our relationship with money right, it can make all of life miserable. So today, reward the extra effort we all made to brave the snow and the cold to be in this place and give us an insight or two that we can take with us that can help us become better money managers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So in your mind's eye, try to picture the scene that's being described in our gospel passage today. Thousands upon thousands of people have gathered to hear Jesus, and he begins to teach. But in the middle of his teaching, we're told that he was interrupted by someone in the crowd. Luke chapter 12 and verse 13 says, someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, Tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me. It must have been an awkward moment. Apparently, his brother was right there with him. Imagine if in the middle of today's service, one of you were to cry out to me and say, Jeff, tell my spouse that he or she needs to do this, that, or the other. It would be a really awkward moment, right? So this man has interrupted Jesus' teaching, say, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Understand that in that time, in that culture, it was customary for the eldest brother to get a double portion of the inheritance. So if there were two brothers, the elder brother stood to receive 2/3 of the estate, the younger brother 1/3. So apparently the younger brother is saying, Jesus, tell my older brother to divide the estate with me 50-50, even Stephen. It's not difficult to imagine the tension that must have been roiling in that family leading up to their father's death. His brother pits himself against brother. I can imagine the younger brother saying, I have done as much for dad as you have. Why should you get a double share? I'm more responsible for you than you are anyway. I can imagine the older brother saying, you just couldn't wait till dad died so you could get your hands on that money. And I see that tension spilling out, not just into their lives, but into their family. And so Jesus uses this is an occasion to talk to us about our relationship with money. He tells us a story, a parable, about a farmer whose crops were producing so much, the harvest was outstripping the capacity of his barns to hold it. So the farmer thought to himself, what am I going to do? I know, he said to himself, Luke 12:18, I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I'll store all my grain and all my goods. And then I will say to my soul, soul, now you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. Do you see the tragic mistake this farmer was making? The mistake is not that he was coming up with strategic plans to allow his business to continue to grow. That's just good common sense. That's just good stewardship. The tragic mistake he's making is the attitude, the perspective on life that he's carrying with him that's implicit in the words that he speaks. It's clear from how he expresses himself here that in his mind, he believes that to be truly happy in life, he first has to attain a certain level of prosperity. Then he can relax. Then life will be good. Then he can be merry. And so he throws everything that he's got, all of himself, into creating and getting to this certain level of prosperity so that then he can finally kick back and enjoy life. Problem is, Jesus says, that night, in his sleep, unexpectedly, he died, never having kicked back and enjoyed life. What a waste. Jesus calls him a fool. Jesus goes on to say in Luke 12:15, beware, for your life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Let those words sink into your soul today. The essence of life is not found in money or in the things that money can buy. Author Max Licato tells the story of how he became an avid cyclist. A friend of his at church who was a cyclist said, Max, I think you'd really like it. You should get a bike. You should try it out. So Max says, I bought a bike. I bought those clip-in shoes. I bought some spandex. He says, I went all out. And I started riding and discovered that I loved it. Then he said, my friend said, you need some more stuff for your bike if you're going to have the full biking experience. And so Max says, I started buying all kinds of gadgets for my bike. I bought a speedometer and I bought a pulse rate monitor, and I bought a device that tells me the incline of the hill that I'm going up. Before long, he said, I had gadgets upon gadgets. I had completely tricked out my bike. Then he said, my cyclist friend said to me, you would be a better biker if you'd listen to hard rock while you're biking. So Max bought some expensive headphones, and now he was listening to music as he biked, until one day he wrecked his bike. He asked another friend if he could borrow his bike. It was a stripped-down, bare-bones bike. And of all days, Max says, I forgot my headphones that day. So it was just him and a stripped-down bike. Max says it was a different experience. And it was absolutely delightful. Delightful. He said, that day I got back to cycling for the pure joy of cycling. Wide open spaces, big blue sky, wind in his face, air in his lungs, the pure joy of movement. It was heavenly. What an important metaphor for our lives. What a parable for our times. The essence of life is not found in tricking out our lives with all kinds of gadgets. In fact, those very gadgets can become the kind of clutter in life that tends to burden us and distract us from that which is truly important in our lives. And before we know it, we can end up becoming the slaves of all the stuff that's in our life. This is one of Jesus' core teachings. Beware, for your life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. He tells us that not because he wants us to experience deprivation, but because he wants us to truly be able to experience the wonder, the beauty, the sweetness of life. Jesus put it this way in Matthew 6:24, you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve God and wealth. I cannot experience the true beauty that God wants me to experience in my life if I let myself become a slave to money and the things that it can buy. A German shepherd, a Doberman, and a cat all died and found themselves at the pearly gates. God greeted them there, sitting on the throne, and said to the three of them, I want each of you to tell me what it is that you truly believe in. The German shepherd said, I believe in training and discipline and loyalty to my master. God said, that is wonderful. You can sit here on my right hand. Then God said to the Doberman, what is it that you truly believe in? The Doberman said, I believe in love and caring and protecting my master. Wonderful, God said, you can sit here at my left hand. Then God said to the cat, what do you believe in? The cat looked God in the eye and said, I believe you're in my seat. Money is like that cat. Money would like to take the place of God in your life. Problem is, God is a gentle shepherd who seeks to lead us beside still waters. Money can be a cruel taskmaster. Money can be like a virus that invades the body and to survive has to keep replicating itself over and over again until it eats you up inside. Money says to you, you need more of me. You need one more of me, another one of me, another one of me, another. And before long, it eats up our life. It consumes our life. Dave Ramsey, the author of the famous course, Financial Peace, puts it this way. Money makes a fantastic servant, but a horrible master. If you don't tell your money where to go and what to do, it will definitely master you and the rest of your life. Don't misunderstand, the point is not that we as followers of Jesus should be indifferent to money, or that we should ignore money, or that we shouldn't care about money. Money is a very important part of our lives. In fact, that's the point. The point is, it is so important that we need to be intentional about how we relate to it. If we don't master our money will soon master us. So, what does it look like for us to master our money? As I was thinking about this, it occurred to me that maybe the most meaningful thing I could share this morning is to briefly review some of the key principles that Dave Ramsey covers in that course, Financial Peace. Some of you have experienced that course. You may know that hundreds of churches across America have used that course. Thousands of people have been changed in their life's relationship with money through that course. It doesn't mean that Dave Ramsey's principles are infallible, but they certainly, they make a great checklist for us to benchmark ourselves against some common sense financial principles and think more deeply about how do I feel about how I am relating to money. So, I've distilled four principles out of Ramsey's teachings that I want to share with us today. The first of these principles, also core to the teachings of Jesus, is discover the beauty of simplicity and take pride in it. We live in a world and in a culture that has inundated us with hundreds of messages each day about finding goodness in life in the stuff of material things. Jesus calls us to a very countercultural perspective. Simple living is good. I remember the first moment in my life when that concept smacked me up the side of my face. I was in Montreal, Canada, touring St. Joseph's Basilica, the largest church in Canada, built on the grounds of a monastery that became famous in the early 1900s for the ministry of a monk named Brother André Bessette, who had the gift of healing prayer. So thousands of people would descend upon that monastery seeking prayer from Brother André. Hundreds received miraculous cures, and so even after he died, people, pilgrims by the thousands, still flock to that monastery and to St. Joseph's Basilica. In fact, there's a huge hall in the basilica that is lined on either side with row after row of prayer candles where people come and light prayer candles for healing for themselves and for loved ones. It's an amazing sight. But the most memorable part of that tour for me was when they took us out back to the dormitories where the monks lived and took us up to the second floor to show us the room that Brother André lived most of his life in, exactly the way it was on the day he died. Here's this powerful person who had a huge impact, lived a profoundly meaningful life, and I'm thinking to myself, this will be interesting to see what his nest was like, what his living space was like. I walked into that room and was struck by its utter starkness. A simple 10 by 10 room, bare floor, bare walls, a small print hanging on one of the walls, a twin bed without a headboard, a small wooden desk, a wooden chair, a few books on the desk, nothing else except a window, a glorious window that looked out onto the lawn and the trees of the monastery grounds. And as I stood there in my 20s, experiencing, taking in the environment of this room, my first thought was, how does anybody ever live like this? It's so stark. My second thought was, there's something profound here. There's something indescribably beautiful here. Here is somebody who had only what he needed so that he could focus the rest of himself on that which mattered most in life. Life's experiences, the people around you, serving, making a difference in the world. And as I stood there, I thought, he is so rich, or he was so rich, and I am so poor. I wonder if in my life I will ever find the courage to live even a tenth of the way Brother André did, counter-culturally. Beware, Jesus says, for your life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. There's an old folk tale that you may have heard before, but it's a powerful reminder. The folk tale is about a wealthy woman who had a teenage daughter who had only in her life experienced luxury, and mom wanted her daughter to understand how lucky she was and how most people didn't live that way, and so mom takes her for an overnight trip out into the countryside where they spend the night with a poor farm family. As they're headed home the next day, mom says to her teenage daughter, what did you think? Wow, mom, she says, thank you for taking me there. I learned so much. Mom says, well, talk to me about that. What did you learn? Her daughter says, I learned that we have one dog, but they have four. I learned that we have a pool that goes halfway out into our garden, but they have a stream that never ends. I learned that we have a lantern that lights our garden, but they have the moon and the stars. I learned that we buy our food, but they grow their own food. We live on 20 acres, but they have fields that surround them for as far as the eye can see. I learned that we have a wall that protects our house, but they have friends that look after them. Her mom was speechless at this point. Her daughter goes on to say, Mom, thank you for showing me how poor we are and how much better life can be. There's a lot of wisdom in that. The simple things in life are what make it worthwhile, are what give us joy. So why do we give so much of ourselves to accumulation of stuff and stuff and more stuff? A family made the difficult decision that it was time to put their elderly, frail father in a care facility. So they chose the best possible facility, the best that money can buy. It was a beautifully appointed care facility with wonderful, attentive caregivers, a low caregiver-to-resident ratio. It was, of course, difficult to leave their dad there that first night. The next morning, the caretakers awakened him, bathed him, dressed him, fed him a wonderful breakfast, and then situated him in a big overstuffed chair looking out a window onto a sun-drenched garden. As the old man sat there, before long he began to tilt a little bit to the right, and an attentive caregiver rushed over and sat him back up straight so he wouldn't topple out of the chair. Before long he began listing to the left. Another attentive caregiver noticed, rushed up, set him up straight again. This happened several more times. Before long, it was lunchtime. Family drops by to check in. Dad, how's it going? Oh, it's pretty nice, he says, but there is one problem. What is it? Dad says, they won't let me fart. Sometimes it's the simple pleasures that make life good, right? So don't ever let somebody else define the good life for you. Dare to be your own man. Dare to be your own woman. We have been inundated with messages of what makes life good. Be cynical about that. Step back and think about what truly makes you happy. Dare to live counterculturally as Jesus called us to. It's the first key foundational principle for mastering our money. Discover the beauty of simplicity and take pride in it. Take pride in saying, I can't afford that. Instead of impressing people with all of your stuff, what if we took a healthy pride in how simple we live, modeling a different way? Which then leads us to the second key principle, according to Dave Ramsey. Unplug from consumer debt and discover the power of what he calls a sinking fund. Neil McGregor has written a book that's pretty well known called The History of the World Told in 100 Objects. He walks us through 100 inventions that had a profound impact on the course of human history. One of those 100 things he talks about is the invention of the credit card. It may not occur to us, but the credit card wasn't invented until the mid-20th century. It did not become popular until somewhere in the middle of the 1960s. When I was growing up in the 1960s, my parents had no credit cards. Because most of us have lived all or most of our life inundated by credit cards, it's hard for us to appreciate, McGregor points out, how much credit cards have changed how we human beings relate to money and stuff. When I was a kid, my parents had no credit cards. We lived in a simple house, simple furniture, much of it hand-me-downs passed through the family. One day when my mom was flipping through a catalog, she got her eye set on a marble table A small display table with an oval marble top and carved wooden legs. She talked to Dad about it, and they decided that they were going to start saving for it. So every month they would put away what they could, a little bit, into savings, until about a year later, they were able to buy the marble table. I remember the day it arrived. It was so exciting. Mom put it right in front of the picture window in the living room, put some fake flowers on it and the family Bible, and warned us kids to stay away from it. It was by far the nicest piece of furniture, the only show piece of furniture that we had. 50 years later now, that same marble table still sits in front of the picture window in my parents' living room, looking like it did on the day it was new. That's how my parents did it. That's how most everybody did it back then. And because of that, they didn't have the constant stress of consumer debt payments taking up a big chunk of every paycheck. Maybe that older way was better. A lot of old things need to pass away. But maybe that's an old thing that it would do us good to start moving back toward. The Bible puts it this way, Proverbs 22:7, the borrower is slave to the lender. Dave Ramsey gives a simple example to help us think about this a little bit. He gives the example. Suppose you get your eye on a dining room set that you want to purchase. It's $4,000. And suppose you purchase it on credit at 24% interest. That means you will pay $211 per month for 24 months until you pay it off, so that your total investment in that dining room set will be $5,064 when you include interest. That's how we make most of our large consumer purchases in our life these days. But Ramsey reminds us that there's a different way to do that. What if instead, each month, we paid ourselves $211 and put it in a savings account, what he calls a sinking fund? It would take 19 months, not 24 months, to accumulate $4,000, with which we could then purchase that dining room set for cash, allowing us to pocket the extra $1,064 that we would have paid in interest and put it into our retirement or invest it in something else we want or need or share it with others. That's a 20% difference, $1,064 of savings. And then imagine if after that you continued paying yourself $211 a month until you could afford to make your next consumer purchase and then the next and the next, so that over the course of a lifetime you'd end up acquiring all the same things as we do now, buying everything on credit. The only thing that would be different is there needs to be a 19-month period at the outset where I defer that initial purchase and save it up, so that instead of always looking back and paying for what I already have, I'm now paying it forward, and over the course of a lifetime end up saving thousands upon thousands of dollars that gets invested or can be shared or can be put back into something else I need or want. When you look at it that way, I don't know about you, but it causes me to stop and say, you know, maybe there is a better way to go about this. You may say, well, Jeff, what about all that consumer debt I've already got? Dave Ramsey suggests a practical strategy for overcoming that debt. He calls it the debt snowball, and it works like this. Step one, list out all of your debt, all your consumer debt, from the smallest to the largest. Step two, pay down your smallest consumer debt as rapidly as you can. Step three, once you've paid off that first debt, take the amount you were paying on that first debt and add it to what you're already paying for your second debt each month, so that you pay off your second debt even faster. Once your second smallest debt is paid off, take what you were paying for your first debt and your second smallest debt and add both to what you are currently paying on your third smallest debt and pay that off even faster, and so on and so forth as you move down through them. He suggests we start with our smallest first because it builds momentum. It allows us to get that psychological win of, hey, I've paid off a debt, and now too, I'm building some momentum, and it begins to train us in a new way of thinking. What would it look like if we would get off the debt treadmill? He's not infallible. I'm just saying, Let's think about it. It challenges me. How about you? Principle number two. Principle number three, and I'm going to start moving really quick now because we run out of time. Principle three, Ramsey says, is create a budget and then spend to budget. Jesus in Luke chapter 14, verse 28 says, which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost to see whether you have enough to complete it? Otherwise, when you've laid a foundation and are not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule you, saying, this person began to build and was not able to finish. Jesus is making a simple common sense observation. You got to lay financial plans for the important things you want to do in life. Our church here could not survive without a budget. Every business we patronize could not thrive without a budget. So why would it surprise us that our personal household finances are stressful and struggling if we haven't taken the time to create a budget? Dave Ramsey says, a budget is me telling my money what to do. No budget is my money telling me what to do. If you're interested in experimenting with a personal household budget, there's a great free online resource also produced by Financial Peace that can be found at the website that's called everydollar.com. And I've printed that under sermon notes on the bottom of page 2 of your worship bulletin. Everydollar.com gives you a beautiful free template that walks you through step by step how to create your own personal budget. If this calls to you, if this resonates with you, give it a shot this week and see how it feels. Principle number three. Because what we do with our money matters a great deal. And God has gifted us with a lot of money. It may not feel like it. But do you realize that every person here today, including the poorest among us here today, that every single one of us enjoys a standard of living that is better than 99.4% of all humans who've ever lived. Think about that. Of the 80 so billion people who've lived on planet Earth, by virtue of being alive in America in the 21st century, every single one of us are in the top 1% of wealth in the history of the world. We ought to be able to live on that without being stressed. If we apply simple common sense. And there ought to be enough left over to save a little and to give a little, which is the fourth point that Dave Ramsey makes. He suggests that we build giving and saving into our budget as a top line priority. Jesus says, to whom much is given, of them shall much be required. Think of it this way. Imagine that you've got a really important package that needs to be delivered to somebody who really needs it. And so you go to the UPS store and you ship it overnight. But the next day on the UPS truck, the delivery man, instead of delivering it, takes it home. You confront the delivery man and say, why did you take it home? He says, well, if you didn't want me to have it, why did you give it to me? And you say, because you're the delivery man. And you were supposed to deliver it to the person who needed it. I wonder how often God says that to us. God entrusts us with much, and much of that is to be used to support our life, but some of that is not for me. It's for somebody else. I'm just supposed to be the delivery man that gets it where it's supposed to go to someone who needs it deeply, spiritually, materially. To whom much is given, of them much will be required. We can't experience financial peace without, among other things, sharing of what God has given us. So, here are four core principles. There's much more to financial peace, but these are four of the core principles. Which one of these four principles most resonates with you as an area for potential growth in your life? Maybe none of them do. As I said at the outset, he's not infallible. And it's perfectly fine to come to church and say, yeah, that was interesting, but it's not for me. It's perfectly fine to come to this church and go home and say, the preacher was full of it today, because I'm sure there are Sundays when I'm full of it. We're not the kind of church where the preacher throws something out and everybody salutes and says, it must be infallible, it must be right. So look at these principles critically, think about them, and if they call to you, you might want to put one or more of these principles in your spiritual action plan. Right now, some of us, those of us who want to, are in the process of creating a 2019 spiritual action plan. Those action plans consist of two simple parts. Part one, what are the spiritual practices I feel called to commit to this year to keep myself spiritually centered? And you list out one, two, or three, whatever the practices are you feel called to. Part two, what life growth goals do I feel called to in 2019? And you list a goal or two that you feel called to, growth edges in your life. If you need a copy of the template for a spiritual action plan, there are extra copies out at the welcome desk. Some of us may feel called to incorporate one or more of these principles into our growth objectives for 2019, because if we don't master our money, it's going to master us. Let me close with this. Near the start of the sermon, I told a disparaging story about cats, so let me make up for it. I want to introduce you to a cat that I believe captures the essence of what we're talking about today. Take a look. This cat gets by without any legs, any front legs. Meet Abel. Abel lost his legs from an electric shock, but he hasn't let that slow him down. He lives up to his name and can do anything a normal cat can. He just does it his own way. And even though he may be different, he loves life just as much as anybody. He puts the able in capable. Abel reminds us that it's not how much we have so much as what we do with what we have. You can be a cat and have two legs and have a fabulous life. And you can be a cat with four legs and find a way to be miserable. Maybe our challenge financially is not to have and find and get more money, but rather to make the most of what we already have by becoming better money managers so that we can experience financial peace. We can do this, folks. We can take charge. We can be free people. Simple is good. Take pride in it. Beware, your life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Amen.